and no exhaustion of aging and death. Likewise, there is no suffering, origin, cessation, or path, no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no nonentity. Therefore, Shariputra, because there is no attainment, Bodhisattvas rely on and abide in the perfection of wisdom. Their minds have no obstruction or no fear. Passing utterly beyond perversity, they attain the final nirvana. Also, all the Buddhas who reside perfectly in the three times, having relied upon the perfection of wisdom, became manifest and complete Buddhas in the state of unsurpassed, perfect, and complete enlightenment. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the equal to the unequal, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, since it is not false, should be known as the truth. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is proclaimed. Tatyatha om gate gate paragate parasam gate bodhe soha. Shariputra, a bodhisattva, great being, should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like this. Then the blessed one arose from that concentration and said to the superior Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva, the great being, that he had spoken well. Good, good, O son of the lineage. It is like that, since it is like that, just as you have revealed. In that way, the profound perfection of wisdom should be practiced. Also rejoice. When the Blessed One had said this, the Venerable Shariputra, the Subhidu Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the Great Being, and that entire circle of disciples, as well as the worldly beings, gods, humans, demigods, and spirits were delighted and highly praised what had been spoken by the Blessed One. Tatyatha om gate gate paragate parasam gate bodhe soha. Tatyatha om gate gate paragate parasam gate bodhe soha. Tatyatha om gate gate paragate parasam gate bodhe soha. Namo Guru Buddha Dharma Sangha and the Great Mother Prajnaparamita. Through the power and strength of making prostrations to you all, may these true words of ours be achieved. Just as before, when by contemplating the profound meaning of the perfection of wisdom and reciting its words, Indra overcame all the harms of Maras, non-humans, and so forth. In the same way, by our contemplating the profound meaning of perfection of wisdom and reciting its words, may all the harms towards our spiritual practices, such as Maras, non-humans, be overcome. May they become non-existent. May they be pacified. May they be thoroughly pacified. May I beseech you to thoroughly pacify all the outer and inner obstacles of harm for the achievement of perfect enlightenment. May all kinds of interferences, diseases, and possessing spirits be passive. May we be separated from unfavorable conditions, and may we achieve favorable conditions and everything excellent. Through this fortune, may there be at this time happiness and health. I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Sangha until enlightenment. May I achieve Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings by means of gathering merit, such as by performing generosity. I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Sangha until enlightenment is attained. May I achieve Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings by means of gathering merit, such as by performing generosity. I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Sangha until enlightenment is attained. May I achieve Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings by means of gathering merit, such as by performing generosity. May all sentient beings possess happiness and cause of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings not be parted from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings dwell in equanimity, which is free from attachment and anger towards both near ones and distant ones. There are no other great monks, even in heaven, like you, the great man leader. Not in this world, not even in the place of Vaishvaravana, not in the finest places of heavenly palace, and not even in the four directions and four intermediate directions. How could they be if I search you everywhere on this service, including mountains and forests? Salutations to Maitreya, the Dharma region, who dwells in Tushita, whose fire of great compassion burns the fuel which is anger. Light ray of transcendental wisdom removes the darkness of ignorance and liberates sentient beings from samsara. Homage, I respectfully pay homage to Guru and protector Reverend Manjugosha. Your intelligence shines forth like the sun, unclouded by the two obscurations. You hold a scriptural text at your heart, symbolic of seeing all the things as they are. Those who are caught in the prison of samsara are confused in the darkness of ignorance and are overwhelmed by their suffering. Your speech with the 60 melodious ways, you preach the sentient beings to whom you are compassionate as to your only child. Your proclamation of Dharma is like a roaring thunder that awakens beings from the stupor of delusion, frees them from the iron chains of their karma. You wield a sword of wisdom, heaving down suffering wherever it sprouts, clearing away the darkness of ignorance. Primordially pure, your princely body is the embodiment of the perfection. Dwelling on the tenth bhumi, I pay homage to Manjugosha, who dispels ignorance and whose body is adorned with 112 atoms or marks of a Buddha. With the brilliance of your wisdom, O compassionate one, illuminate the darkness enclosing my mind, enlighten my intelligence and wisdom so that I may gain insight of truth into the words of the Buddha and texts that explain. Homage to Nagarjuna, who bestowed us 100 rivers of multitude treatises, who manifested 1,000 waves of the collection of Madhyamika texts, who is beautiful with thousands of precious qualities. Homage to Guru Shantideva, who had meditated in Nalanda, composed treatises and gone to the sky. You who have white eyes, knowing all objects of knowledge. You who possesses compassion for all sentient beings to achieve wholesomeness and goodness. You who possesses the power of performing inconceivable activities. I respectfully prostrate to you, the Guru Manjugosha. Having smeared the ground with scented water and scattered flowers on it, this Mount Semeru adorned with four continents, sun and moon, by offering it to the Buddha field, may all sentient beings enjoy the perfectly pure Buddha land. May you turn the wheel of Dharma that is common to both Hinayana and Mahayana, according to the minds of sentient beings and different capacity of their intellect. Negating the conception to be eliminated, the apprehension of true existence. This section, this section shows that we really can negate our manner of conceiving the dual appearances, because they are many reasonings, logical reasonings, which prove that concept, that the concept which apprehends the dual appearances, the mere appearances, as a inherently existent or truly existent, as a misconception, because such apprehension, our normal apprehension, such our normal conventional apprehension, which is rooted in the ignorance of the not only the true, not only the ultimate reality of the dual appearances, but also our concept is naturally sort of our concept or the apprehension towards the mere appearances are also mere appearances. Their relative reality also is mistaken, also are mistaken in their relative, would say, the reality. So in order to sort of, in order to shape up our, the manner of viewing or perceiving the dual appearances, we need to follow the reasonings which disprove the conceiving something as truly existent, as well as the reasonings which establish the normal kind of conceiving or apprehension as a, the reasonings also establish the correct and the perfect manner of any perceiving or conceiving the dual appearances. So first, refuting the true existence of subject and object as we normally conceive, as well as the realist, not only the heretic schools, but also the three sort of lower realist Buddhist, ancient Buddhist, what say, the school. According to the realists, both the object and consciousness of it, both the objective aspect and the subjective aspect, I think we should take instance of the dual appearances of our eye perception. Among the dual appearances, I have found that the dual appearances of the eye sort of perception, and among the six kinds of dual appearances, when we talk about the six sort of kinds of perceptions, there are also six sort of kinds of dual appearances. Among these, the dual appearances of the eye perception and the dual appearances of the ear perception, these two are, when we are awake, we are bound to conceive the dual appearances of eye perception and the ear perception. We are mostly sort of bound in that these two sort of dual appearances. When we smell something, that is seldom, quite seldom compared to these two. And the taste, we taste very, very seldom in a day. In a day, we take breakfast, bad sort of tea or bad coffee early in the morning, then breakfast, then we take something, or maybe six or seven times a day, we taste something here. And that time we have a dual appearances on the tongue perception. And the touching also, when we wear something or when we sit on the hard or soft sort of any seats, then we experience, or when we burn or when we feel sort of cold or when we feel hot or when we feel some kind of light or any heavy, or then there is a dual appearances on the perception of body. And then the sixth mind also. Sixth mind, we think normally we sort of speculate when we are awake. We speculate and it's so much. So among the six kinds of dual appearances, we normally are bound in mostly among the outer sort of what you call the objects. We are mostly bound in these two. And then also we are bound in the dual appearances of our, what's a perception of sixth mind consciousness. So I take instance of, in order to explain this, I take instance of the visual, what's a, the appearances, dual appearances. Both the object means when we see something while we are in our room, while we are with someone, or while we are outside, or outside in the city, or while we are outside in the sort of countryside, or anywhere, we have these object aspects, or the objective appearance, objective aspect, as well as our eye perception, and it perceives or sees these visible forms, then we also have the consciousness of it, means the subjective aspect, the eye perception. So the realists, in accordance to when they sort of delineate the reality, they delineate the reality of these dual appearances. According to realists, not only the ordinary sentient beings. Of course, ordinary sentient beings conceive these as a truly existence, not out of some kind of reasoning, but out of strong sort of tendencies left within the mental stream from the beginningless time. Out of that tendency, strong tendency, when we have these dual appearances, we sort of automatically or we naturally sort of conceive them as a truly existent, or conceive them as a inherently existent. Whereas the realist school, who advocate the objective aspect and the subjective aspect as a truly existent, they conceive them as a truly existent out of logical reasoning, which is in accordance to them is a logic, is a valid reasoning. But in accordance with the higher intellectual, in accordance with the Madhyamika followers, the people who are faith, or who have inspiration in the Madhyamikas, the teenagers, who have the sort of strong sort of believing faith or inspiring faith, inspiration in the Madhyamika's approach. It's a level of understanding of the reality of the two kinds of the appearances, the dual appearances. They view the logical reason of the realist as a invalid, because that reason does not, that those reasons, and he forwarded those reasons sort of forwarded by the realist do not sort of accord with the actual fact or the actual reality of the phenomena. So in order to know the different interpretations between the different schools, we first need to sort of establish within ourselves which one is invalid, which one is invalid reasoning, which one is valid reasonings. And then we really be, we will be able to follow the correct tenet. of it have truly existed. However, they are in a very difficult position because there is no valid proof for their assertion. There is no valid proof for their assertion, whereas their assertion can be refuted, refuted by the higher sort of level of reasonings, sort of generated out of higher level of intellectual sort of understanding or intellectual state. If you assert that the true existence of object is established from the truly existent sense faculties of the consciousness, in another word, if we ask why the objective aspect is truly existent, they would sort of forward the this reason, because of the subjective aspect, because of the truly existent subjective aspect, and they say that they can prove that objective aspect is also truly existent. Now to refute that that sort of clarification or that answer, that the logical support, what reasoning, what can be established as truly existent? I think what reasoning do you have to establish? What reasoning do you have to establish the consciousness as truly existence? Although you may establish the objective aspects as truly existence from by the reasoning of the truly existence of consciousness. But what reasoning do you have to establish the consciousness as truly existent? The realist, on the other hand, we can also say that consciousness is established as truly existent, or the subjective aspect. Subjective aspect among the dual appearances, the subjective aspect can be established as truly existent from the object it is conscious of, from the object, from the truly existent of the object. Objective aspect. Now the Madhyamika. What reasoning do you have to establish object as truly existent? If the objective aspect and the subjective aspect mutually sort of exist inherently through the force of one another. Then when one is not established as truly existent, when any of them is not established as truly existent, the other will also not be so established. And in that case, they would both be non-truly existent. For example, if someone has no son, if a male has no son, he cannot be posited or he cannot be designated as a father. And also, if there is no one designated or posited as a father, where can the child come from? There will be no beings who can be sort of posited or the designated as a child, son or daughter of that father. In this way, since without a child there is no father, means without a lay man cannot be sort of posited or called, cannot be called a father. And without a father, a layman who is not posited or who cannot be sort of designated as a father, like a young boy or a young man who is not married and who has no child, he cannot be sort of called as father. Without a father, there's no child. In both cases, they can be neither. Likewise, from the example, without the subjective aspect, there is no something which can be posited or which can be designated as a objective sort of aspect. Without the objective sort of aspect, there's no entity which can be posited or designated as a subjective sort of aspect. Likewise, the object and the consciousness cannot exist independently of one another. In another word, these two are dependent. These two are, mutually sort of dependent on each other. To call the visible sort of form as an object, there must be the subjective aspect. On relying on that subjective sort of aspect, then we posit the object, the thing to be perceived as an object or objective aspect. Similarly, in vice versa, similarly, without the objective, the thing to be sort of perceived or thing to be sort of known, they would not be the subjective aspect. They would not be the thing or entity which can be deposited or designated as a subjective aspect. On the contrary, through dependence we can establish things as truly existence. That is really sort of giving some kind of reasoning or clarification to prove their principle stand. For example, since a sprout is produced from a seed, we can understand the truly existent of the seed from the sprout, because the seed sort of produces the sprout. So from the production of the sprout, they said that we can understand the truly existent of the seed, even though the sprout depends upon it. Likewise, why can we not understand that there is truly existent object of consciousness from the consciousness which is produced, from the consciousness which is produced from it? Madhyamika, the refutation for that sort of backup reasoning. This is not the same thing. This reason does not sort of, this example does not have the same sort of any significance with the assertion to be proved by you. This is not the same thing. The existence of the seed can be understood by seeing the sprout, the result from it, with a consciousness that is other than the sprout. Because the sprout and the seed, they are inanimate sort of entities. Inanimate entities, and seed cannot sort of understand from the production of sprout that it itself is truly existent or inherently existence. There must be another entity, the mind of the beings to know the relationship of the causal and the resultant relationship between the seed and the sprout. Yet what mind can understand a truly existent consciousness that understands a truly existent object of consciousness? It is impossible to cognize a truly existent consciousness, since such a thing means truly existent consciousness does not exist in reality. It is just imputation of your own sort of misconception or misunderstanding of the reality of the dual appearances. Now, establishing emptiness of truly existent, in another word, the negation of the truly existent, the non-true, from the viewpoint of the cause. The non-Buddhist Charvakas, the realist, nihilist school, one of the heretic school which advocate causes and result. Everything sort of arises by itself. Everything sort of arises by itself, assert that all things are produced from no cause, because in one of their scriptures it states, all things such as the rising of the sun in the morning from the east, the far flowing of the water downhill, the roundness of peas, the sharpness of thorns, and the tail feathers of the peacock were not made by anyone, were not sort of produced or not made or were not compounded by anyone, any causes and conditions. They arise, all these entity or all these things, phenomena arise from their own nature. This is their main assertion or main tenet or main view. This assertion is unacceptable because sometimes the production of an event effect from the collection of all its causes can be seen even by the direct perception, even by the ordinary beings, what say, direct perceptions of the worldlings, worldly people or the worldling. For example, we see in the farm that the sprout and then the farm or the rice field or the maize sort of corn field or wherever or fruit sort of farm or wherever, from our own sort of direct perception, the eye, not sort of affected by eye perception, which is not affected by a certain sort of erroneous any diseases or certain erroneous any certain which is not affected by certain erroneous any condition, we all sort of commonly or equally see the production of the agriculture in the farm by the assembly of different causes and condition. So it is understood through inference that variety among effects, such as the different stems of lotus flowers, is produced because of their having a variety of causes. So this would say the direct perception of the worldling, this also can sort of establish their main assertion as a misconception, their main assertion as a wrong sort of view, a wrong view of the actual relative reality of the phenomena, especially the relative reality of the compounded phenomena. Sharvaka, yet by what has this variety of causes been made? All the various kinds of the causes and conditions are made of. If you, the Buddhist school, especially the Madhyamika school, assert that all compounded phenomena, especially the present, the compounded phenomena are being produced from the different causes and conditions, then what has this variety of causes been made? Madhyamika, by a variety previous any causes and conditions. All the causes and conditions that produces the result or that produces the effects arises, they are being generated. All the causes and conditions are also being generated by the previous causes and the conditions. For what reason is a distinct, likewise, so from in this sort of statement, in this statement we can also sort of understand the present state of our mind, where the Buddhist sort of, from the Buddhist point of view, the mind is known as impermanent. All the, what's say, although we naturally conceive it as a permanent because of the continuum, because of not knowing the actual reality of the continuum, because of not knowing the actual reality of the continuum as well as the actual reality of the mind itself, the indivisible momentary, the actual relative reality of our mind itself. We out of our natural, let's say, understanding, natural sort of any concept, we regard the mind as the permanent. And then we don't sort of believe in the previous sort of causes of the mind, the primary cause. For example, the primary causes of the present state of mind, present indivisible in a state of mind, we do not understand that it is sort of generated. The present state of an indivisible and moment of mind is being generated, is generated by the earlier and by the earlier indivisible state of mind. And that one also is being generated by the earlier. And then if we go up and up and up and up and up, go farther up, 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 then there's no beginning. That is why in Buddhist approach, it says that the individual, the cyclic existence has no beginning. Cyclic existence has no beginning because cannot find the beginning of our beginning, the beginning of our, let's say, the consciousness, the mind. So by the variety of previous causes, for what reason is a distinct cause? Distinct cause. For what reason is a distinct cause any able to produce a distinct effect? For example, the wheat seed and the rice seed or any kinds of grains, they sort of produces their own sort of, let's say, effect, a distinct. The rice seed cannot produce the sprout of wheat or corn, or that is the actuality, relative sort of actually the relative fact. That is the relative fact at the relative level. For what reason is a distinct this comes from the force of its previous causes. The force of its previous causes. For example, between the mental, the ripened alaya between the human and the ripened alaya of the animal. Ripened alaya of the human and ripened alaya of the animal. Although they are when we talk about the Buddha nature of the human being and the Buddha nature of the animal, it is the same. Indivisibility of the mere clarity and the mere clarity and its ultimate reality, the inexpressibility. The dog's mind, the dog's ripened alaya also has that, and the human also has that. But because of the different sort of causes of afflictions and the different sort of karmas, then that mere clarity manifest into a ripened alaya of the dark. Ripened alaya, right? That mere clarity manifested into a ripened alaya of the dark, ripened alaya of the human differently because of different previous, distinct causes. Also, the conditions as well, different conditions. This comes from the force of its previous causes. Not only the outer sort of compounded entity, but also the inner. Among our feelings as well, for example, when we take our sort of suffering, I mean, when we take frustration, there are so many levels of frustration which arise in us, sometimes stronger, sometimes weaker, sometimes it's really very sort of long-lasting, sometimes short-lasting. So different kinds of. All these different effects arise from different sort of causes and different conditions. Because of different causes and conditions, the effects also varies. Effects or the outcome, the result also varies in that way. Refuting production from a permanent cause. Permanent cause. The non-Buddhist Nyayikas and Vaisheshikas believed the cause of everything to be God Ishvara. So the creator in some Hindu, there's a creator who create all these, everything who create the content and the container and all different kinds of the container, all different kinds of beings, not only the six kinds of beings, but also within sort of human, we have so many different kinds of any sort of nationalities, so many different kinds of races and castes and so on. So they believe that all these are produced by the Ishvara. He has five qualities. Ishvara has five qualities, namely divinity, purity, and being worthy of veneration, permanence. So like out of a blind sort of faith, the Indians or the people who follow this tenet or this school, they really out of blind faith, they spend their life in sort of venerating, in obeying, in following the doctrines and preached in that school. So permanence, oneness, and being the creator of everything. Matemika, if you accept Ishvara to be the cause of all beings, then one moment, please. What exactly is Ishvara? First, we want to know the very cause of everything, the Ishvara. What is the definition? What is the characteristic, unique characteristic? What is the unique characteristic of the Ishvara? Or unique characteristic or unique features to define the Ishvara? What are those? Now he gives the answer. He's the great element. He is the great element of earth, water, element of water, element of fire, element of air, and element of space. This will come in the Abhidharma. Normally we, the worldlings, who haven't sort of entered into any kind of school, whose sort of way of conceiving the appearances, whose way of conceiving the appearances is not influenced by any of the schools, any of the tenets of the different religions. They normally conceive the water which we drink, which we sort of use for bathing, or which flows in the water, in the river, which is in the ocean or any kind of lake. We regard that as a water. Here it's talking about the element of water. Four elements, water, earth, fire, air. This comes in the category of, not in the category of visible form. These do not come in the category of visible form. These four elements come in the category of tactile object, something to be felt by the body perception. So, for instance, the table here, or this, or here. Here we see the stiffness. That is known as the stiffness. We feel the stiffness, the hardness. That is the element of earth. And when we feel here, we also feel the wetness. That is the wetness is the element of water. And we feel the heat. We feel the heat. That heat is the element of fire, not the fire on the stove, not the fire in the flame. The flame is visible. The flame is the visible sort of form, and the heat of the flame is the element of fire. We need to differentiate, because in the Abhidharma, when they give the different sort of objects of different perceptions. And as I said earlier, it is totally different from we think that water can be seen. Water can be tasted. Huh? Water can be tasted. Water can be sort of, yeah. So element of water, element of fire, element of air. Air is the movement. Not only the wind or the storm or This is not the element of element. It has the, I think, element of air in it. The storm which we see, which we can sort of, which we can see is not the element of air. Element of air is inside also. Every sort of, what's called, gross, every gross, what's the outer, outer matter, inanimated things, like visible forms, sound, smell, taste, and the tactile objects. All these are known as a jungyurgisuk, jungalekyurbisuk. Jungalekyurbisuk means form or matter. Matter that had been produced by the four great elements. So any kind of matter, not only the visible form, but also the sound, smell, taste, and the touch, they all consist of the four kinds of elements. So now we can, if we sort of reflect on that meaning a little bit deeply, if there is some kind of, what's the basis for them to view in that way. There is a basis of that, actually. He's the great elements of water, earth, water, fire, air, and space. Element of space, this is a little bit, this is exceptional in Buddhist sort of Abhidhamma Kosha. In accordance with Abhidhamma Kosha, the matters that is produced by the matters, all the matters, outer objects, we can say, the outer objects, all the external sort of entities are being produced of four elements, not the element of space. Element of space, and the space is different. Element of space is referred to the space in our nose, the space in our nose, and then space in some kind of hall, in accordance with the Abhidhamma Kosha. The space itself, the outer space, is not a karagatire. It is not an element of space. It is a space. It is a nitirva, the uncompounded phenomena. But I don't know how this, the heretic school, the Vaisashika and the Nayayikas, how they sort of assert the unique characteristic of the element of space. I don't know. Indeed, these elements are the causes of whatever is formed from them. That is referring to the external objects, external entities, including the sound, smell, taste, and the tactile object, something to be sort of felt, or the object of the body perception. Formed from them, we also, in accordance with the Buddhists, it also sort of believe in that at the relative level. All the matters, external matters, or the objects are being produced by the four kinds of elements. But why tie ourselves out over the mere name Ishvara that you have posited to them, posited to the elements? If Ishvara is really identical, if you really refer Ishvara to the four elements, then there's no basis to be debated or discussed. He means that we also believe in that at a relative level. This is not worth arguing about. In any case, with this assertion, you contradict your own definition or your own sort of unique characteristic of Ishvara. Because since earth and the other great elements are multiple, other great includes, I think here, excluding the Dirva, the element of space. Since other great elements are multiple, impermanent, without conscious movement, for example, the earth. Here also, although our element of earth within our body, inside in our body, is sort of any associated or is associated or is connected with the mind. It's connected with the mind. The element of the earth in the body itself is not a consciousness. It itself is not a Dirva consciousness. So without conscious movement, not divine, something trodden upon, for example, on the road or on the lawn or in our room, on the floor of our room, or we step on the element or the all kinds of elements. They consist of the four kinds of elements. They are made of four kinds of elements. So we trodden upon, and they are unclean. There cannot be any Ishvara. There cannot be Ishvara. Space too is not Ishvara because it is unmoving. I think here refers to the space. Here refers to the uncompounded here also. In accordance with the Vaibhashika, the element of space and the space are different. Element of space is subsumed in the compounded phenomena in accordance with the Vaibhashika. Also in the Abhidhamma Kosha, which is the presentation on the phenomena in accordance with the Vaibhashika, mainly in accordance with the Vaibhashika school. Not Aishvara, because it is unmoving, and the self is not him, and the self is not him either. The self, the object of our egoism, the self, or the personality, our individual sort of personality or self is not Ishvara either, because the conscious self or the subtle personality is already been refuted as a truly existent above. Furthermore, if we cannot conceive of the Creator Ishvara, what is the point of trying to describe this inconceivable entity? Moreover, exactly what effect is Ishvara asserted to produce? So, asking him now, what are the productions produced by this cause or this creator? Niyayika, niyayika. He creates the self, the atomic particles of earth element, and so forth. All the particles of the other elements as well as the latter continuity of himself, the Ishvara himself. Madhemika, yet don't you accept the nature of these things to be permanent? If you do, it is contradictory to say that they are produced because of accepting them as a permanent nature, accepting them as a like Buddhists, when we follow the higher level of the approach, Buddhist approach. For instance, the Madhyamika, Prasangika approach from the viewpoint of slightly sort of examining the relative state. Then Prasangika also sort of accept all the dual appearances as a nature of mere mind, one's mere mind. Likewise, this heretic school, they say that these are all the manifestation from the self to the relative truth. All are manifestations of the Ishvara. All are the results of results or manifestations of the Ishvara, and they all sort of rooted in the Ishvara. They are the ultimately a nature of the Ishvara. So it's quite similar. There are many sort of similarity in sort of any, even though the principal sort of tenet or principal any finding is totally sort of different, like permanent, impermanent, permanent ultimately, impermanent, we regard the mind as a impermanent at the relative level, impermanent relative level, and then neither permanent nor sort of impermanent, neither sort of emptiness nor any non-emptiness, the truly existence at the ultimate level. That is the big difference between the school. Consciousness is not produced by Ishvara. Its particular states, for example, the negative mental state or positive mental state or the neutral mental state, when we sort of generate a thought in our mind, its particular states arise from the various objects of consciousness, various sort of kinds of objects, various kinds of objects. They do not sort of arise from the permanent Ishvara, as you sort of advocated, or as you sort of you have found from your sort of from your understanding or from your that reasoning, which you might regard as a valid, and its mere cognitive nature. Its mere cognitive nature means, even though we have a different sort of thoughts, some negative, some positive, some sort of neutral, they all have the same sort of an nature at the relative level. That is the mere, what's the mind, mere clarity or the mere mind. Mere cognitive nature, to refer that, mere cognitive nature arises from a beginningless series of previous mere cognition, previous mere cognition. So our mere sort of clarity, that arises not from the, that is not produced from the Ishvara or the Creator. Christians also believe in the God, God who creates all of us, all different kinds of cyclic existence. So, beginningless series of previous cognitions. Pleasure and pain, too, are produced from wholesome and unwholesome actions. Mainly, the main sort of main cause of our pleasure, our sort of suffering, our different state, different economic state, different sort of physical state, different levels of understanding, different levels of different sort of kinds of different kinds of, we have different kinds of many things, different kinds of belief as well, different kinds of are produced from wholesome and unwholesome actions respectively. Therefore, please tell me what effects are produced by Ishvara. If the cause, Ishvara, the permanent producer of effects, has no beginning, how can the effects of pleasure and so forth have a beginning? He's talking about the present, the very present sort of any manifested state of the pleasure or the pain, talking about that have a beginning, so forth have a beginning refers to that. Similarly, since Ishvara also has no end, why would pleasure and pain not always exist? They also would exist permanently. They also would sort of be there within the sentient beings permanently. According to you, they should exist in this way. Means in accordance with your sort of approach or your any the tenet, your finding, any the pains and pleasure, and it must exist permanently in this way or permanently. But in reality, in actual sort of actuality, or in our relative reality, it's talking about here, that the relative reality, they are clearly occasional phenomena. They arises and ceases, and there sometimes arises pains and pleasure, arises sometimes and then ceases. They are occasional sort of phenomena. They are not regarded or they are not felt as a permanent as you advocated. It is not necessary that Ishvara always produces effects, because although he is permanent, he depends upon other occasional condition in order to produce different kinds of effects. Yet it would follow that Ishvara cannot depend upon anything else, because there are no phenomena other than those that have been created by him. Therefore, upon what does his production of effects depend? So again, the condition, occasional condition, which they talk later in order to cover up their main sort of, what say, the approach. They talk about the occasional condition. That also is not true or not correct, because everything first has to be from their viewpoint, in accordance with their tenet. Everything first has to be sort of created or produced by the Ishvara. If he dependent upon a group of other conditions, it will follow that those conditions themselves would become the cause of all kind of effects instead of Ishvara. This is so because when the causes and conditions were assembled, Ishvara would have no power. For when the cause and condition of some kind of happy feeling or some kind of any suffering or when the causes and condition to generate wisdom is assembled, when the causes and condition of the ignorance or the opposite of what say the corrupted wisdom is assembled, are being assembled, then the corrupted wisdom will sort of arise in us and remain in us as long as the causes and conditions of it is there. Assembly of causes and condition of it is there, as long as the assembly of the causes and conditions of the corrupt understanding is there, it will remain there. So this explanation or the meaning can be sort of applied to many different kinds of effects within ourselves, outside as well. Ishvara would have no power not to produce the effect. Then there will be Ishvara have no power to obstruct the effects or the outcome to generate or to be generated or to be sort of any to be arisen. And without these causes and conditions, other causes and conditions, he would have no power to produce effects. Without the causes and conditions, he has no power. He might wish to keep, like we say, Krishna's followers say, that God has the loving kindness, the greatest loving kindness. God loves us all. If God loves us all, and God wish the happiness to us, God wish it. If the cause of our happiness is only the wish of God, then we must have all the time happiness. There mustn't be the sufferings or the frustration in us. So in actuality, that kind of understanding there is totally, what say, against the actual relative fact. So Ishvara would have no power to produce the effects. If effects were produced without the desire of Ishvara, it would follow that they were under the power of something other than him. Even if effects were created according to his desires, their production would be dependent upon his desires. And if his creation were dependent, what would become of your permanent independent Ishvara? Then your main principle, anikalavare, principle approach of Ishvara, Ishvara to nyamba. I think this would contradict with your main approach, that is to claim the Ishvara as permanent and interdependent. He would be under the power of impermanent desires. In addition, Vaisheshika asserts that both the animate and inanimate worlds are produced. Both the animate and inanimate cyclic existence are produced by permanent atomic particles. This assertion cannot be accepted because we have already refuted the existence of permanent atomic particles above, while establishing the selflessness of body, selflessness of the one body, as we sort of conceive, selflessness of head, selflessness of each branches of the body, in the earlier section or the presentation on the mindful, placing mindfulness of the body, refuted permanent atomic particles above. The Samkhyas believe that all knowable entities can be classified under the conscious self and the material primal substance, together with its manifestations. Samkhya is the principle or the very source of all the other heretic schools, the Hindu schools. So they, like in Buddhism, we would say classify all phenomena into a relative truth and the ultimate truth. They also have this sort of presentation which delineate all the phenomena, while sort of delineating all kinds of phenomena, they classify into these. So conscious self means our object of egoism, the Atma, that egoism they consider or they regard that as a nature of permanent conscious. And then the material means inanimate primal substance, so primal substance, which is known to them as inanimate, or without the mind, primal substance. Material here means primal substance, together with its all the manifestations, like in a form of human or form of animals or form of any other kinds of beings, or then they contained the environments and all these the relative appearances. They regarded them as a manifestations of the primal substance, and the conscious self or the subtle permanent any personality or the Atma, they regard as the agent between the primal substance and the relative truth, the manifestations of the primal substance. Among these two, the self is neither a cause nor an effect, whereas the permanent, partless, material, invisible, and all creating. So this has, this primal substance, from their viewpoint, has four unique sort of four feature, four or five, yeah, five kinds of five features within itself. Permanent, partless, material, invisible, and self-creating is asserted to be the cause of all kind of worldly existences. They speak of a balanced state of three qualities, triguna, of equanimity, pleasure and pain. Balanced state, like three feelings. We have three feelings, and the balanced state of three feeling. Balanced state of three feeling, that is called in their system purity and activity. Raja, purity, that is known as purity. Activity, darkness, as being the primal substance. The balanced state of our three kinds of feelings is all being the primal substance. And they speak of imbalanced states of these three qualities. All states that manifest from initial imbalance of primal substance as being the world, our human form, or all kinds of our thoughts, or all kinds of imbalanced state of our feelings, or different kinds of thoughts, or all these are just a manifestation of that as being the world or relative truth. This primal substance you accept cannot be existent, because it is impossible for something that is truly partless to truly exist, with a threefold nature. Likewise, the qualities cannot truly exist as three, because each of them has three aspects. This latter reason is established because you accept that every truly existent phenomena, the manifestations, has the nature of the three qualities. Furthermore, if the three qualities, the cause, do not truly exist, the existence of phenomena such as sound that are manifested from them as effects becomes extremely far-fetched. It is not possible for clothing and the like, tactile sensations, visual forms, sound, etc., to have the same nature of pleasure and so forth, because they have no conscious quality. The clothing and the tactile object and so on have no conscious quality. They are manifestations of the primal substance, which is matter. Things such as clothing have the nature of pleasure and so forth, because they truly are of nature of their cause, namely the qualities of pleasure, pain, and equanimity, from which they become manifest. Unless you study this under the scholar of their school, I think it is not easy to understand their actual sort of stance from the commentary as well as from the root text. It is not very clear. However, things such as clothing are similar to the body in being composed of parts, and have we not already refuted the true existence of body with our analysis? For example, the clothing or the table, similar analysis which scrutinizes the ultimate reality of the body, we can also sort of scrutinizes the ultimate reality of the cloth we call shirt. This is as a shirt, upper shirt, gown, or any kind, eyeglasses, or microphone. If we really scrutinize this in the similar way the author scrutinizes the ultimate reality of the body and all its branches, then we will not find the microphone. We will not find the existence of the microphone, not only the truly existent, but also the existence of the microphone at the ultimate level. It's talking about that. Similar to the body in being composed of parts, And have we not already refuted the truly existence of the body with our analysis? Furthermore, in your tradition, the cause for clothing and so forth is asserted to be the three qualities of pleasure and so forth. How can this be? Woolen cloth does not arise from pleasure. On the contrary, even conventionally, from the viewpoint of the deluded mental state, which is not affected, although the understanding, the misconception of the heretic school through which they advocate all their findings, that also misunderstanding is a conventional diluted mental state. But that is affected by certain erroneous condition, which is the teacher, which is the belief in that kind of teaching, that kind of approach. Because of being affected or influenced by that erroneous conditions, then their sort of that misunderstanding becomes a false deceptive truth. Within the deceptive truth in Madhyamika Avatara, it classifies the deceptive into deceptive truth or relative truth into two kinds: the true deceptive truth and the false deceptive truth. So the understanding of the heretics, not only the heretics, but also the realist school, out of which they consider something as truly existent, out of which they view something as truly existent. Those understanding or the understanding of the realist are regarded as false deceptive truth, not true deceptive truth. Comparing like our mind which think of the form of the table, when we think of the form of the table, that our sixth mind and our eye perception, they are known as true deceptive truth, because the object which you perceive by these mind, even though they are diluted, the object which perceived by object the form of table, which is perceived by these two sort of the mind, are commonly sort of accepted in our society, whereas the truly existent advocated by the realists is not accepted by the common worldlings. These are the imputations of the realists themselves out of their corrupt wisdom. So there are many things to identify. Where am I? Moreover, upon analysis, the woolen cloth, the cause is found to have no true existence, and therefore pleasure, its effect, can also have no truly existence. Pleasure and other feelings can never be validly apprehended as permanent, because they are occasional phenomena, especially the manifested state of pleasure. And when they talk about this, the pleasure and pain, it is of course referred to the manifested state of the pleasure and the feelings. Unlike the disturbing emotions, when we talk about the disturbing emotion like desirous attachment and hatred, when the text or explains about when the text explain or speak about the desirous attachment and the hatred, we should not regard that term only to the manifested state. We should keep in mind that it also can be sort of referred to the the seed of the desirous attachment, not the powerful what's the tendency or the powerful and seed or the powerful ability within the mind mental stream, which can later and comes into a manifested sort of state. Pleasure and other feelings can never be. Phenomena. If pleasure were always manifestedly present, then why is it not also experienced at times when pain is produced, when pain is in the manifested state? When pain is produced, or in another word, when we sort of feel the pain or we have the suffering, pleasure is not experienced because it becomes very subtle, not because it is not there, because it becomes very subtle, as I have spoken earlier as well. It is overwritten, it is overpowered by the more powerful any feeling of pain. You see. How can something permanent be sometimes gross and sometimes subtle? Since it becomes subtle upon ceasing to be gross, this alternately gross and subtle feeling must be impermanent. For similar reasons, why do you not accept that all manifested things are impermanent, like Buddhists do? Although the various gross and subtle states of pleasure are impermanent, the nature of pleasure, the very nature, it's not difficult, you see. Although the various gross and subtle states of pleasure are impermanent, the very nature of them, the pleasure or the pain, or the very nature of them itself is permanent. Since the gross and subtle forms of pleasure are nothing other than pleasure itself, and since they are impermanent, pleasure itself clearly must be impermanent as well. You accept that something cannot be produced by nothing because it does not exist in the nothingness. Just as oil can never come from sand. Thus, while you do not accept the production of manifest entities that were previously non-entity, you do claim that manifest entities must abide at the time of their cause. This is the Samkhya, like the sprout. They say the sprout, when the sprout sort of comes out from the seed underneath the soil, underneath the soil, in their approach, they consider the sprout is there. The very nature of sprout is in the seed, even the seed is not sort of any sown in the field. When the seed is in dry state, when the seed is in the bag, the sprout is there. The nature of the sprout is there in the seed, and it is in a non-manifested sort of state. The sprout is in the seed in a non-manifested state. They regard the seed and the sprout as identical. So when the sprout and it comes out in the manifested sort of, that the manifested state is and generated by the causes and condition, not the sprout itself. The sprout is manifested and state of the sprout is generated by produced by the seed. That means that they consider it as a self-production by self. The sprout or any kind of effects cannot be sort of produced by any other than itself. It has to be produced by itself. Because of that approach or main sort of tenet of arising, tenet with regard to the arising of the compounded phenomena, they had to sort of talking about that. You do claim the manifest entities must abide at the time of their cause, because although at that previous time they are in an unmanifest state, later at the time of the effect they arise in a manifested form. However, if the effect abided in the cause, to eat food would be to eat excrement, and you should purchase and wear cotton seed with the money instead of paying for the clothing, which is the production of the cotton seeds, production from the cotton seeds. Although things do exist in this way, the confused people of the world, now this Samkhya, they say that although the things do exist in the way they sort of advocate it, in the way they assert it, the confused people of the world do not wear cotton seeds because they cannot see clothing in them. They cannot realize or they cannot any view the clothing in them. In another word, like we say, we are ignorance. We do not sort of realize the impermanent of the compounded phenomena. Although we perceive the form, sound, smell, and so on, we conceive them as the permanent. We do not have the ability to perceive the subtle nature, the impermanent. Likewise, the Samkhya school also assert in the similar way. They say that. Yet even Kapila, the founder of your tradition, whom you expect as a knower of truth, wore clothing and not cotton seeds. Thus, this must have been true for him as well. Furthermore, because in your tradition, a knower of truth, the effect would exist in a worldly person. So every sort of worldly, especially every worldly person who are not in the path, who do not engage in the practices, every ordinary worldlings, must be the knower of the truth. Then why do worldlings not see clothing in the seeds? It follows that they should see the seed in the clothing in the seed, because of being the knower of the truth Indeed, a knower of truth does exist in its cause, a worldly person, but at the time of being a cause, all the states of mind of worldly beings are invalid. Therefore, they do not understand the clothing exists in cotton seeds. In that case, even the effects such as food, clothing, knower of truth, etc., that they clearly see would be untrue, because they too would be objects of deceived minds. If according to you, Madhyamikas, even valid cognition are not valid, deceived, wouldn't the emptiness they understand also be false? It must be. Therefore, meditation upon ultimate truth of emptiness is surely incorrect. This is really a good, refutation. Really, very challenging refutation. We need to really reflect on this particular objection, towards the Madhyamika approach by the Samkhya. We need to reflect on this again and again. Madhyamika, without contacting, apprehending the true existence which the mind has imputed, one will not apprehend its non-true existence, its emptiness. In order to know that, we need to know the different manners of perceiving of the different mental states, the direct perception and the non-conceptual state and the conceptual state. All the perceptions are classified into conceptual and non-conceptual state, and these two kinds of minds have a totally different manner of engaging in their objects. The non-conceptual sort of mind, for example, the eye perception, it engages directly It engages directly without eliminating something. Without eliminating something, without eliminating something, they directly engage in their object. That is called Dumjuk. Dumjuk in, I now forgot. I've forgotten the English term for that. One is eliminating engager, and what is the another? Do you remember? You don't remember. Dumjuk, Seljuk, eliminating engager, and when our conceptual state, mind, engages in there in its respective object, then it engages through eliminating the opposite. When we think of Buddha by our mind, that conceptual state, that conceptual understanding engage in its object, the Buddha, through eliminating the non-Buddha. Through eliminating the non-Buddha, then it perceives or it engage in the, it perceives the Buddha. Whereas when our eye perception sees the historical Buddha, it engages directly without eliminating the non-Buddha, without eliminating non-Buddha. This have to be known. This is important in order to reflect what say on this refutation, on this challenging. This I have found a very challenging refutation from the Samkhya school. In order to know accurately the meaning of this, in order to clear away this objection and forwarded by the Samkhya school to our own, we need to know the two manners of engagement in their object by the two kinds of perceptions, two kinds of mental states. Without contour the emptiness, in the same way, similar, which the mind has imputed, one will not be apprehended. This also can be known from that 33 of the ninth chapter. Stanza 33 of the ninth chapter, we also can know a little bit from that also. Stanza 33, yeah, especially the first two lines. First two lines of the stanza 33, then we will understand the meaning of that, the objection as well as the answer given by the Madhyamika. In the same way, without having thought of the sons of a barren woman, one cannot consider his death. And because non-true existence is dependent upon true existence, the non-true existence, that is a negation of the true, negation of the false existence, also is clearly false. Nevertheless, it is quite valid to meditate on emptiness because it is the remedy that eliminates. It is the direct remedy, or it is the most supreme sort of remedy that eliminates the apprehension of truly existence. For example, when his child dies in a dream, the dreamer's thought of the child's non-existence causes the thought of the child's existence to cease. Although the thought of his non-existence is false, it still has the ability to dispel the thought of his existence. Therefore, when such an analysis is made with these reasonings, no permanent thing is found to exist with no cause and no individual cause or condition or any assembly of condition is found to have existed from the very beginning. Since truly existing phenomena do not come anew from somewhere or something else, in the beginning they are not produced, in the middle they do not remain, and in the end they do not go elsewhere upon cessation. How then are all these things, which under analysis are not established, although they are apprehended as true by our conventional deluded mental state, not different from illusions? They appear to be truly existent, whereas in fact they are not. Okay. With this merit, may I attain omniscience and defeat the fears of mental afflictions. May all sentient beings be liberated from the ocean of samsara, which is disturbed by the strong waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. Just as Manjugosha knows all, so as Samantrabhadra does, may I follow all of them and dedicate all the merits. The place which became a supreme refuge, nourishing the northern area, filled with oceans of scholars and saints. May the subtle teachings which illuminate the teachings of the Buddha in the land of snow prosper.